Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. My name's Jake Entwistle and joining me this week to talk about Unai and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at their respective wheels, Raheem Sterling, Frank Ribery, Liverpool, Bayern Munich, Champions League, and also a Squawker 6 at the end of it. My first guest is Mohamed Butt. How are you?
I'm a bit under the weather, but you know, I'm going to tough it out. I'm going to gut it out because I just had to be here for the podcast. You got to get it done.
Have the winds been taking their toll on you?
The winds and mainly just children and diseases.
That same old excuse again. And joining me, I think, over the weather is Will.
Hi. Is that your revenge for when I stalled after you didn't ask me how I was?
No, that was me trying to be funny in the saying that you seem to be quite perky this morning. So is over the weather a term that is used rather than under?
I don't think it's a term that exists.
Let's make it a term that exists.
Hello. Well,
it does now.
Okay.
Do you feel over the weather?
I do. I'm happy to be a lot to come along for the ride.
Good. So, keeping the theme of riding and vehicles and wheels, we will talk about the Arsenal game first. And the stat we're going to lead with is the number 12, which is the number of points Arsenal have picked up against top six opposition under Unai Emery, which is twice as many as they managed under Arsene Wenger in the whole of last season. So the question is, after Sunday's win against Man United, which was pretty much Arsenal Solskjaering Solskjaer's Man United, if we're going to be honest, have Arsenal progress this season? Is that result in itself proof of that? Will, we'll go with you first.
It is, for the stat you just gave, that's objective progress. And overall, there was a sort of Sporting Intel tweet, I think it came out after the game, I'm pretty sure, in that, and it says, and it revealed that they've acquired 30% more points than they managed by this stage of last term, and that's a higher increase in terms of the rate than Liverpool and indeed any other Big Six team. I think only West Ham's record is better in that regard. So that's objective progress. And generally there's difference as well in terms of playing style. I think in this game we saw the sort of cloppishness almost of Emery's style and how phases of play sort of live upon a knife edge in terms of whether the Arsenal player like wins his one-on-one, whether they're stood in the right place, blocking the right passing lane to pick up the ball on the break. And in this regard, we obviously saw Aaron Ramsey have a really, really good game in terms of like one-on-one duels. The amount of tackles he won is obviously the stat that most people will have seen. He won 8, which is more than anyone else on the pitch. So they'll be sorry to see him go, but the good news is they've got Ainsley Maitland-Niles having what is being talked about as his breakthrough performance. So in this game, for instance, he made the most interceptions across the Premier League this game week with 5. And looks like an Emery-esque player in that regard.
The most striking thing was that he was awful in the first half.
Huh?
It's made well, Niles. No, so what, well, I'm, what I'm about to say is his response to being quite poor in the first half was outstanding, because in the second half he was brilliant. He hadn't made any tackles in the first half and looked like he was struggling. The left-hand side looked really, really easy for Man United to create chances. Luke Shaw got on the overlap and got a few crosses in as well, working with Pogba. But then the second half, something was said or he perked himself up even more, made those 4 tackles and obviously most of those interceptions as well.
I'm not sure I came away. The impression of the game I came away with is that he had a good game. I don't know if I would go so far to say that he was awful in the first half, but whatever. I would also say that Kolasinac looked pretty decent as well, and there's that sense in which the fullbacks being key again and that back line that Emery's put out looking quite composed. Mm.
In another
game against the Big Six.
It shows the value of the good old fashioned tactical matchup. There's a reason why three at the back died out for so long, and it's because people started playing one up front. And the whole point of three at the back, why it evolved and why it became such a dangerous system, is because you have 2 defenders who can essentially man mark and 1 covering defender. You have a man advantage at the back at all times. When you play one up front, you end up having 2 spearmen at the back, and that's pointless. And that's why Marcelo Bielsa, one of the great managers in the world, he doesn't, everyone says, oh, he plays 3 at the back. No, he alternates between 3 and 4 at the back, depending on how many strikers the opponent has, because he always wants to have 1 man and 3 at the back. So, it was in many ways United playing their usual formation with 2 strikers sort of played into Arsenal's hands here. I mean, Emery was very, very, very well set up his defence. His midfield, as well, this is the other thing, he gambled on playing in transition, which is, it was classic Emery in a way, because it was like he sort of said, okay, look, let's not, previous matches against United and other teams, he's put loads of midfielders in there, but in this game he thought, okay, let's make Aaron Ramsey go full Ever Banega. You know, let's put this guy who is ostensibly a number 10, put him into the central midfield, just let him unleash his full skill set. Let's have Xhaka sit there and pass and be the holder. And then we'll have three guys who don't necessarily want them to track back, but that means that we can send everyone else back and we still have this incredibly dangerous counter-attacking threat. Every time they hit the ball long, went to those guys, there was a counter on, and United were like, oh, what do we do? What do we do? Lindelof really struggled with that, with the pace of Aubameyang, with the movement of Lacazette. Chris Smalling had a better game, but even he was, they're both the key thing he did was, like you said, he Solskjaer'd. He pulled his defence back. He counter-attacked with very, very mobile, fluid forwards. Mesut Ozil's movement was great. His overall play, maybe not as up to his high level, but he basically played it. Emery played it huge. And this is the difference between Arsene Wenger and Unai Emery. Everyone loved Arsene Wenger. Unai Emery is an actual brilliant coach. Like, genuinely, tactically, he's phenomenal. In terms of improving players, he's also great. Yeah, all he needed was players. Like, at Sevilla, he worked wonders. I mean, on numerous occasions against Barcelona, against Real Madrid, against Atletico Madrid. But he was often just found wanting for quality. At Arsenal, he has genuinely great players. And it really...
Yeah, but he's been benching those, though.
Well...
This is Ozil and Ramsey played, and Arsenal won. They're the genuinely great players in the team. Yeah, one of them's leaving at the end of the season, and one can't play.
Well, I mean,
so that point in itself is a bit of like, wait, hold on.
Yeah, but maybe this is the example. I mean, the Aaron Ramsey thing, I don't think Emery wanted to lose Aaron Ramsey. I think that was kind of a club thing rather than him. But you look at Ozil. Ozil's a confused situation because I have no idea why he doesn't play that much, because the way that Emery likes to play, Ozil makes so much sense. But I don't know.
It's generally refreshing to see a manager, like a top six manager, as sort of flexible and like changeable as Unai Emery. And you've got to say, like, when you saw, you've spoken about how Ozil often in and out of the team, Ramsey gone in the summer, but I mean, he couldn't have named more of a crowd-pleasing line.
Oh no, I'm not criticizing Emery. I'm just saying it's that certain bit about using great players. It's like, well, there's been other occasions where he could have played a similar team, you'd imagine, and maybe would have reaped rewards from it. Because the one thing as well is actually, again, from my point of view, is you mentioned Chris Smalling having a fairly decent game. He pretty much shut down Aubameyang. He kept stride with him for every chance, and I don't think Aubameyang himself managed to get the better of him. The key for me was Arsenal's little number 9, who showed that despite being about 5'8", 9, ability to pin back a defender and hold the ball up that allowed other people to flood forward when it was just a counter-attack was massive. And then him holding the ball, then giving it to Kasinac, that sort of the pattern of play was get it to Lacazette. Aubameyang wasn't very good with his back to goal. Give it to Lacazette, pin it, drop it back to Mesut Ozil. Mesut Ozil sprays it to Kolasinac. Kolasinac then whips it across, and that's where Aubameyang was appearing and looked like he might get a tap in.
It was very well designed, the whole system play. You know?
And that's the thing, is the Man United formation that we said about them playing two up front. They've been playing two up front, but they've had that little false nine, free-roaming 10, whatever you want to call it, against Arsenal, but Pogba was operating from the left, fulfilling that to an extent, but as I said, was working with Luke Shaw really closely, and they created chances from that side, but they massively missed having Lingard or even Pereira in recent weeks fulfilling that role.
Quite pinned back at stages as well, like sort of attending to his defensive
team. Yeah, there was only a couple of instances where Dalot really got down the right, and I mean, there's that one chance for Rashford was sort of on his heels. But I mean, essentially they really missed Jesse Lingard in this game. The movement of Jesse Lingard, or even Juan Mata, but especially, obviously Lingard is so good at the Emirates as well. I mean, so good in London in general, really. But yeah, they really missed someone who, because like you said, they had the two up front, and what they could have done to make Arsenal's back three suffer was to then have Lingard, because then, okay, you've got the spare man, but if Lingard's constantly moving around, the spare man is just following him all the time, so it destabilises the defence. But because they didn't have that, and they played a very orthodox... I thought it was a strange letter from Solskjaer, and it kind of worked, but I thought they looked much brighter once they matched formation with Arsenal, kind of. I thought that was a much smarter thing, because Dalot looked more comfortable playing as an orthodox wing back. Shaw's been brilliant the last few weeks, by the way. I mean, shout out to Luke Shaw. And then in midfield, Pogba looked a bit more comfortable playing in a more traditional a sort of central role.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a masterclass from Emery, really. I mean, and just like last week when he did the same thing and his players kind of let him down, didn't really, you know, he did it.
Well, that's the thing, Lacazette again actually missing. The one criticism from Lacazette's game in recent weeks is that he's not actually taking the chances, but he's been involved now in a goal in each of his last 7 Premier League home games, only the 6th Arsenal player to do that. Thierry Henry's record of 17 is going to take a lot of doing, but they've found that he's become a true fan favourite at the Emirates now, and the adoration for him and what he did with Aubameyang for the penalty especially is he's cementing himself as that real focal point and the player that Arsenal fans get behind.
It all ties into like why Wenger initially signed him. You could make the case that Wenger possibly feels he left a Luis Suarez type for Emery at Arsenal, in that Wenger just about stopped shy of comparing Lacazette to Luis Suarez when he first joined, making the point that he makes players around him better. Mm. And Arsenal really needed someone like that, someone selfish, selfless, but streetwise, evidenced by the way he's won the penalty there against Fred, which was...
Yeah, it's another penalty cheeky, one, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, very soft one. So Emery's key Arsenal player really is someone who's much more willing to muck in than the talisman of the Wenger era, which is Sanchez. Like, Emery's key player is like the anti-Sanchez in that sense. In that, of course, Sanchez was world class, but he was always there was always a sense that he was like dragging the team to relative success, or disassociating himself from their failures through like sort of performative gestures of angst.
Gloves in the air.
Yeah, exactly. So Lacazette like mucks in, but I mean, he has massive quality beyond that of a dog's body, of course. And you know, as you've said, his impact there sort of just is kind of goes under the radar somewhat.
Yeah, I think it definitely does, and I think it's because he's missing those chances. And Aubameyang scores, so it's like, oh, Aubameyang's nearly one goal behind Sergio Aguero now for score the most since Alexis Sanchez in the season, so it's very easy to be like, wow, Aubameyang's scoring goals, but the part Lacazette plays in facilitating that is massive. And just to wrap up the point on Arsenal then, if Emery wins the last 3 home games this season, which are Newcastle at home, Crystal Palace and Brighton, then it'll be the first time ever an Arsenal manager has won 50 home points in a league season. He's on 41 at the moment, can get 9 more. So if we're talking about progress, breaking a record in your first season, despite having a bit of luck along the way, is going to be very impressive.
The conditions haven't been ideal either. Like, no. All the stuff going on behind the scenes with the sporting director and Sven Mintzelaar sort of chucking in.
Yeah. And with Monchi, obviously.
Because he's just leaving. Yeah. The Arsenal in the lurch.
So really. Again, they might not do that. It might lose all 3. It could be a complete unwinding of that.
Totally for
but,
the person.
But to have that even in sight is a testament to, again, continuation of Arsenal's... Emirates is all often criticised for being library quiet and stuff, but their form there in recent seasons has actually been reminiscent of what you would call a fortress side.
There was a piece today from Sky Sports, actually, in which Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher both gave their thoughts on how Emery's progressed Arsenal. And they both said that the change in atmosphere at the Emirates is worth noting. And
I think that's more born out of how the toxicity of it
under Wenger.
On the last season, totally, so, which had a negative effect.
But Arsenal fans are kind of like always expecting the sort of it's happening again element, and that creates anxiety there. So it hasn't all been going as well.
Being at the game at the Emirates yesterday, it was definitely a great atmosphere. It was definitely a good performance. Man United will, for the first time, feel like they've been on the wrong end of the... of the XG gods, as is going around, because they actually... If you take away the penalty in open play, they created the higher quality chances, obviously hitting the woodwork twice. First defeat under Solskjaer, just quick on this. Is this a sign that maybe it was a very nice... There wasn't any bumps in the road while Ollie's at the wheel for this first 9 games, especially from away from home? That's the first time they haven't even scored away from home under Solskjaer yet. Just quick word, Mo, on that. Is this why it's been right to just not give him the job and get sort of sucked in by all the fuel?
Yeah, 100%. Look, he's hit a couple of potholes in the road now. The PSG one, he managed to recover himself and get back on there. This is a bigger pothole. He's bumped off league defeat, no goals away from home. But you know, let's see if he can steady himself and get back on track in the mid. Yeah, get back in the middle of the middle lane as well. I mean, look, this is the thing. It's a strange thing. I don't think necessarily the game has impacted his prospects of getting the job at all. If anything, it's almost helped him because, as much as, okay, look, they lost, right? 2-0, that's not good. You lose to a top four rival, that's not good. Mm. But two things. One thing is Spurs lost the day before, so the top four is still only 3 points away.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, they played really well. Like, really, really, and it was like you said, exactly like you said, it was like the typical Man United just play away to Arsenal is to go there, get hammered, and win anyway. That's like, that goes back, I don't know, like, the middle, like at least 10 years, probably even longer than 10 years. Fergie's been doing that to Arsenal. Go there, sit, defend, they'll attack, and then hit them on a break and score. And that's tried and true. That happens every time. Last year, the Emirates, it was a real laugh, and it was all Lingard, Mini Rock, all that stuff. But David De Gea had to play brilliantly in that game.
Oh, yeah. No one's made more saves in a game since that in the Premier League. So
like, it was just absolutely ridiculous that how he played. And it's like this season, it's not the reverse, not the exact reverse, but Leno had a very good game, for instance. I thought he was one of the better players on the pitch. United created loads of chances. Lukaku hit the bar. Should have had a hat trick, really.
Yeah, definitely
could have carried on his record of braces. Had enough chances to do that. How is he going to rebound from this Arsenal defeat now? How are they going to get back on track? If they can do that, then I still think you got to look at him and think, yeah, probably, especially because he's cheap. This is the other thing. So Pochettino's going to be expensive if you're not going to go for him.
Well, that's the thing is, Pochettino, you don't even want to touch him at the moment.
Well, there's that as well.
Spurs now, only four teams have dropped more points from winning positions. Southampton, Fulham, Palace and Huddersfield. So not an elite list.
Yeah.
Not great company to be in. And Pochettino's come out with some Mourinho-esque
looks
analysis.
Yeah.
And it's quite, for the first time in 5 years, the first time I've seen Pochettino look very, very unhappy. Like, what do you make of their...
We're seeing an implosion from Spurs. Like, they're in relegation form. If you look at the form table, which is just like the past five games. So it's all the Premier League clubs ranked by their last five results. They actually come in at 17th, which is just above Bournemouth, Huddersfield and Fulham. So, and since Harry Kane's return, only Fulham have a worse record. I think
they haven't won a Premier League game since Harry Kane returned.
But the real fear, if you're a Spurs fan, sets in upon review of the games they were winning before this bad run of results. You have to go back to New Year's Day for the last convincing win in the Premier League. If I'm not forgetting one, which was like a 3-0 win over Cardiff, I think. More recently, you've had the 3-1 win over Leicester, which we discussed on this podcast and said it was harsh on Leicester.
Yeah.
There was Harry Winks' 93rd minute winner against Fulham, plus two games against Newcastle and Watford, both of which were won after the 80th minute in terms of like when the goals were scored. So that is all done with the benefit of hindsight. And I've personally praised Spurs
for that intervening
period for like exactly like when they're winning those kinds of games, you're talking about like the character and the mentality they've shown, but it doesn't make it less true that they've played like a top four club in only one Premier League game in 2019, and Spurs fans are beginning and Pochettino is having to answer questions from like within the Spurs support now. He's never been known to be like excellent or a truly world-class manager in terms of like in-game management. And that was evident in how he was quite slow to react to the changes made by Hasenhüttl. And he has been mixing up his defence a little bit recently. Mm. So,
I think Spurs now look... Spurs look like... Since the turn of the year, I would agree. They look like a side that doesn't have a very big squad and has never really had to cope with or never really cope very well with the pressures of a multi-front challenge, right? So they're competing for the top four slash in the title race, which was always a ridiculous thing to say, but they were technically, objectively, points-wise, near the title race. And then they had the Champions League as well. And I think they very clearly put a lot of focus on the Champions League, and they did very well against Dortmund. So, and I think that sort of almost distracted them from the league in a sense. Like, look at their last few games around the Champions League since it came back. And like you said, it's relegation form. They've been terrible. And I think it's just... You're seeing now something that this is why I've been so critical of Daniel Levy all season. You can't stand still, which is what they did in the summer. And Pochettino is a brilliant, brilliant coach. He's great at improving players, great at getting his players to play above themselves, play consistently. Look at Sissoko this season from where he was just even last season, but certainly when they signed him, he's been brilliant, right? So Poch is a great, great, world-class coach, but if you give him no additions to the squad whatsoever, and he's relying on making Oliver Skip into, I mean, and with all respect to Oliver Skip, right, because he's a very good, he's a talented young player, but like, if he's the main import into the squad, yeah, from last year, that's not enough. Mm. They need more,
especially when you lose Moussa Dembélé in January.
Yeah, I mean, they lost him at the start of the season,
yeah,
because
he
hasn't really been the same player. So again, you know, you lose a player as important to Spurs as Moussa Dembélé as well.
Well, heralded as most underrated midfielder for so long.
I would say the other side of that coin, though, is that according to quite a few reports, that like Pochettino was turning down a lot of players that were sort of like being pitched to him by their scouting department, and saying, like, I think he's of the mind that, I mean, if they're not good enough to like really challenge for a place in that first team 11, which has been very, very strong, which is a policy that many top managers in the Premier League adopt.
And the thing as well is
that he has no time for them.
Yeah, the thing as well is, I would say about that, again, not like I want to keep defending Pochettino, but again, if you look at the way Spurs are with money and how reticent they are to spend it, it's like he's probably thinking, if I get this wrong, like, then, you know, so like, he, like you said, he's probably very strict on players that he accepts coming in, because it's like, let's say they suggest someone to him and he thinks, okay, he's okay. But what if it's a George Kevin and Kudu? You know, what if it's a Clinton and G? What if it's a play rather than?
He's obviously
thinking, okay, this guy has to be crazy, because otherwise Daniel Levy's not going to give me any money to sign anyone else. So he's obviously thinking. So he's probably, and it's probably just that it's just a negative feedback loop, right? Because Levy is hesitant to pay modern wages and to splash out big money, and understandably so to a degree. They've got a new stadium to pay for, and then.
Which finally has been announced that they're going to at least test some games.
So this form is coming at a terrible time.
Oh, first game. It's going to be reminiscent of Olof Mellberg scoring the first goal.
At least they've got this Champions League run that they can sort of...
And again, against
Dortmund.
A
lot of excitement is pinned to it. And they were very good across both legs. Just clinical in the first. Took their, organised in the second.
Showed two sides, didn't they?
Yeah.
They showed the exact size you need to show to win the Champions League.
And Vertonghen
was
great.
I'm not saying they're going to.
Vertonghen was great in both legs in very different... very big capacities, a great attacking fullback in the first leg, very solid defensive centre back second leg, and I think they will prioritise a run in the Champions League, because I think Pochettino, I mean, whether or not he's consciously, I think he wants to prove his worth.
You
know, top four is like, no one cares, man.
So obviously if they won the Champions League, they'll get into it again. But pinning your hopes on it when you've got a new stadium coming, and then they're so close to being out of that top four now.
I don't imagine the
backlash if this new stadium's held. Remember those famous banners that
the only place to watch
Champions League.
At least they'll probably get a fixture in the Champions League.
It's scary for Spurs, because it's in table wise, 1 point ahead of Arsenal.
3 ahead of United, 4 ahead of Chelsea, and Chelsea have a game in hand,
and they can go to 60 as well. So it's so tight.
If you look at the run-ins, I think Spurs have got quite a few home games sort of stored, whereas Arsenal
wheel them out. Arsenal have got those three.
Arsenal have only got 3 out of the 8, so that's stacked against them.
And
but then again, Spurs have got Man City and Liverpool both of which.
So it's scary times.
I mean, at the start of the season, I tipped Spurs to drop out of the top four just purely because of the squad depth. And you know what? Pochettino, to his immense credit, held off for, now we're into February, into March now. But now it's starting to look like, actually, I might have been right all along, which is really flucky for me, because I was
How humble of you to bring that up then.
I was
going to
say,
on it in that manner.
I was going to say, for the longest time, that prediction looked like it was a stupid thing to do. But
now it doesn't. Oh.
Oh, well, you know.
And now it's funny how you're mentioning it now.
The thing about Pochettino is that you've never heard him say, "Oh, we've finally shown our level," which is, I'm pretty sure that's almost word for word what Mourinho said about him.
Yeah. He said weird stuff like this before. Like,
he's never looked so angry. He's never looked so angry.
He's probably angry with his players, to be fair.
I think he's angry.
I don't know. You see that Mike Dean exchange, like.
Well, that's what I mean. I've never seen him.
In general,
I know he has the potential as a player. He wasn't exactly a nice.
He's
had the potential to be angry, but I've not seen this come out while he's in his suit and tie.
There were some quotes towards the end of last season, if you recall, that fired a starting pistol regarding like these rumours of him just going to Real Madrid. I think he sort of suggested, just before he signed his contract, he was sort of like being quite coy. And so, I mean, he's done this before.
You can tell he's a bit miffed.
He's got a 10-year plan to win a trophy, in the Premier League title. He's going to be there the whole time.
You can tell he's miffed, but I think...
Yeah.
You can't doubt his quality, but at the same time, he's got to calm himself down, because Spurs need to right the ship.
Yeah, they need to right the ship. And as we said, by staying in the Champions League, that's at least a positive.
Yeah.
The new Champions League, or the next Champions League fixture, will be played this week. Man City, obviously involved, still on course for all four titles. And it's mainly because of the form of a certain Raheem Sterling, who picked up a 13-minute hat-trick at the weekend. No player has been involved in more goals this season in the Premier League. 15 goals, 9 assists, nearly a double-double, which is super impressive. Pretty much seems to be the only mainstay in that Pep Guardiola front line. Aguero has found consistent place in there, I think born out of Gabriel Jesus' lack of quality in some games that he's played. But as I said, we're going into the Champions League. Champions League is perceived to be a different competition in itself, has its own level. So is Raheem Sterling not just one of the Premier League's best players at the moment, Mo? Is he one of Europe's best?
I mean, I think so. I think statistically he is. 15 league goals is 17th, I think, among Europe's top five leagues. So that's okay. But then you look at assists, 9 assists. Only Messi, Hazard, Jadon Sancho, Joshua Kimmich, and Ryan Fraser have more.
But Ashley Westwood,
Kimmich and Fraser take set pieces. Hazard, Messi, and Sancho. And Hazard and Messi are and Messi, and Sancho is having a freak season. So you know he's.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, no, I know. It's a weird. But look, I just think he's. He's really brilliant. I've won a record before. I think he's the most special talent England have right now. I rate him higher than Harry Kane. Sorry, everyone, I know. But I think he's just absolutely wonderful to watch. He has everything, dribbling, passing. He can cross, he can shoot, he can play orthodox wing, he can cut inside and score goals. He's even got,
excellent from 3 yards out.
Yeah, I mean, his positioning is great. This is the thing. I mean, you know, it's easy to make fun of tap-ins because it is just like kind of a cheap way to score a goal. But you know what? There's a guy who plays Juventus, scored 50 goals a year, and at least like 10 or 15 of them were just like that. 1 yard out, 2 yards out, tap it in. You know what I mean? They all count. So it's like, and with the way City play with their obsession with cutbacks as well, being able to tap it and being able to in the right position to tap it in. I mean, there were a couple of cutbacks, going back to United Arsenal real quick, there were a couple, two or three United cutbacks that fizzed across the face of the goal. It's like if someone's standing in and tap it in, well, you have a goal.
The most obvious example is that Raheem Sterling scored that literal 2 yarder.
Yeah.
He went off immediately after his hat-trick. 2 minutes, I think, after that, Kyle Walker puts in an absolute dream of a low cross. No one's there.
Yeah.
Well, it's the biggest testament to his positioning that they don't score as many tap-ins when Raheem Sterling's not on the pitch.
There was the one against the Chelsea game as well. What it says to me is that essentially the tax built towards Raheem Sterling at the moment. It's almost like it's the closest thing to a trademark goal of this Man City team is the sort of, the midfielder plays a sort of a through ball to the fullback who's coming down. He cuts it across and it goes in, as like Mo's basically explained. And more often than not, it's Raheem Sterling there. He's like the system player. He's the one around which that signature move is designed to.
And what's funny is that someone that's assisted him so many times doing that is Leroy Sané, who still can't get in the team. But again, the testament to Raheem Sterling being Man City's pretty much their most valuable player is the fact that he plays right wing, he plays
scores,
left wing,
scores.
He's been played false nine.
Yeah.
He's the only one that has played in all those different positions. Sané is perceived as a left winger. Sané plays.
I like the way that Pep's using Sané as well, I think, because I think he's one thing about Sané we discovered last season is that when you play him loads and loads of those, he becomes kind of predictable, and I think teams can key into what he's doing and how he's going to do it. Liverpool showed that very well. And I think maybe if you lose him a little bit less and use Bernardo Silva a bit more, then suddenly when you unleash Sané, it's like, oh my God, it's like a hurricane. So and that could be very clever. Let's see if he does that.
Sinchenko's appeared out of nowhere and just become Mendy and Sané combined.
He's doing very well at fullback. Back to Sterling. He's playing. He's so lucky. He's so good right now. He's even getting lucky. Like the first goal was obviously.
Oh yeah.
You know.
There's no point even dwelling on that.
But my point is, it's like that's a heat check. You know, when that's when you know things are going for you. When the ball deflects off you like that.
I love it how he was still in the motion of putting it in that corner, but it just got kicked into his other leg and still went in that corner.
Like if you watch it at first and you sort of like only half watch it thinking, oh yeah, that's a nice finish, very good.
Sterling!
And then you watch it again, it's like, oh wait, no, it hits that leg and goes, oh okay, fair enough. I think he's absolutely sensational. I think he's going to cause real problems for Schalke.
So this is the thing, to round up the Man City talk. Obviously, a ridiculous game in Germany with Penteleb getting two, and then Sané, who, as we said, is coming on and still making an impact with sublime free kick. He's picked up that technique. He's been refining that whilst he's been on the bench.
Speaking of shooting techniques.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's developed that sort of flat foot slap. And it's going in top corner every time. But surely now back at the Etihad, with the fact that they are 3-2 up. Oh, and guess who scored the winning goal in that game?
Yeah, Raheem Sterling. Exactly.
Man City surely
could. Yeah, I would say that they'll probably paste Schalke all over the Etihad. I thought they would have done it in Germany, but I guess Pep always does kind of struggle away from
home
in Europe.
Well, Pep said that it shows that we're not ready to win the Champions League, yeah, which could be why he's going to run off to Juventus. which he said he's not going to do.
No, Schalke are in dreadful form at the moment as well. It looks like they're conceding pretty much 3 goals every time they play.
I would say 5-2 City.
5-2.
Yeah, I reckon they'll defend.
What a corker!
Their defense.
Tune
will probably,
in. If it reverses the type, then I think at least 3 goals.
I just see the defense might switch off a little bit, let in a couple, but I think they'll be well out of sight before that happens. I think they'll.
Moving from one English club in Champions League action to another this week, Liverpool obviously taking a 0-0 Anfield draw over to Germany. But one player that's probably been their best performer in recent games, Sadio Mane, scored for a 6th Premier League home game in a row.
What a man.
Only 5 players have done that for Liverpool, including Salah, who's not scored in 5 games for the first time in a Liverpool shirt. But Klopp said he was the best player on the pitch. To sort of give him that confidence. But is Mane overshadowing Salah at the moment?
Yes. Yeah.
easy answer.
So, next question.
I'm pretty sure we spoke about this. Obviously, as you say, he's on a streak at the moment. So there have been occasions on which we've spoken about how he's sort of... There's one player more than any other that is the reason Liverpool are still in this title race. It's not Van Dijk, it's not Salah, it's Sadio Mane who's scoring. Sadio Mane more than Van Dijk. I mean, if you look at the goals they've been scoring and if you look at what Liverpool's issue has been in recent games, it's the nerves that settle in after 25 minutes pass and they fail to score. Sadio Mane is consistently chipping in with these opening goals, and there's evidence to suggest, I mean, this is his intention is to sort of overshadow Mohamed Salah and be the big player who steps up and drags Liverpool to potentially to this title. 7 assists he recorded last season, this season only 1. 70 shots last season, already this season he's got 67, so he's trying to get in there with the goals and
being selfish.
Being selfish, but you need your forwards to be selfish. You need players to step up and make their contributions count. And I mean, more goals than Salah if you exclude the penalty goals. So he's overshadowing.
And it's his joint best ever league season in his career.
To me, what you're seeing with Mane is just the player's his intelligence. Because obviously, look, Liverpool last season had the front three, and this was amazing. But Salah, obviously, because he was so absurdly good, stole all the headlines. And Firmino, to a degree, because Klopp just wouldn't shut up about how great he was. So everyone sort of forgot that Sadio Mane was actually really good. And then the Champions League final, he was the best of the three of them, even before Salah got injured. But
and he scored in every single round of the Champions League last season.
You look at this season, he's almost now, he's realised, obviously, first off, he's very good anyway. That's the first thing. Second thing, he's realised, okay, everyone's doubling up on Salah to stop him from scoring because they're terrified of him now. Firmino is going to draw traffic because everyone says how good he is, so he's drawing double team. Plus, that's how Firmino plays. He's very clever like that anyway, to draw double teams constantly. So what he's doing is he's just moving off the ball into space constantly. And like the way that he scored his goal, it was classic Mane. He's just, the ball was breaks. Okay, fine, it's a lucky break that it falls his way, but he's standing in like a mile of space. He's constantly in the right position to score goals. He scored 8 goals in 2019 in 12 games. 6 of them have been essential, like the second goal at the weekend and the second goal against Watford. Okay, you could argue whatever,
but there's Mane's second goal though that was like Liverpool fans were bricking it.
That's
at
true.
That point, because I mean,
yeah, Burnley had gone
it,
back
it looks like oh god. I would like to just add, despite everything I've just said about Mane developing a bit more of a sort of selfish edge, everything in his gestures and his passing after he got like his first goal suggested to me that he did actually really want Salah to score.
Well, why didn't he square it to him in the last moment of the game then?
I mean,
He can't have wanted him to score that much. And now, Mohamed Salah can't break Alan Shearer's of the fastest half century for a single club in the Premier League.
There's a limit to selflessness. I mean, if you've got an open goal,
he needed to do. If Liverpool had a penalty, he would have let Salah take it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Salah would just be taking it. I mean, it was.
I just think Mane is
hugging like Aubameyang's face.
I mean, yeah, I just think he's so intelligent the way he moves off the ball, and he picks spots where he has to stand. He's just so good. He reminds me of the way Pedro used to be for Spain, Barcelona, and even Chelsea at first when he showed up. He just off the ball movement is just incredible. His use of space is incredible, and he lets defenders gravitate to these magnetic geniuses, Mohamed Salah, Roberto Firmino, and he's happy to let them think of him as just a worker, because then that means he's not a worker. He shows up and he's brilliant. He's got amazing shooting technique. He's got great dribbling skills.
Showreel of back heels.
You know, he's just a phenomenal player. And it's like everyone forgets how good he is, and he's like, that's great. You forget how good I am, because I'm going to stay over here and I'm going to show up and I'm going to score all these goals.
It's funny as well, because the main criticism of him is usually that he misses quite a few.
But that's the Cavani syndrome, isn't it? It's how good is his movement. He's constantly
They say the same thing about Mohamed Salah.
Mane specifically, that he makes some odd decisions in front of goal that are like quite clearly like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, I remember there was one game where he just seemed hell-bent on scoring an overhead kick and just kept overhead kicking it. And it's like his desire to become... And again, it's not negative. It's just saying that the player that scored in six consecutive home games and being the most important player this year has turned around that sort of thing of like, Mane, if you scored, we'd be ahead. Because he should have scored against Bayern Munich.
Yes.
That is 100% a justifiable criticism of his game.
What I'm saying is like, now it's a chance to do what he did against Berlin against Bayern Munich's past, but now they go to Germany and Bayern Munich have scored 11 goals in their last two Bundesliga games.
Dropping very few points.
Franck Ribéry, hat-trick of assists, could have just come out of nowhere to get revenge for never being crowned Ballon d'Or winner. He could be looking to do that.
What, Liverpool?
Well, no, I'm just saying the Champions League, he's won the Champions League before and then he never got the Ballon d'Or, so he wants to do everything possible to win it
again. And he did not like that as well, by the way. He was not happy.
That's what I'm saying. So the fastest... loads of substitutes this weekend as well were just coming off the bench and doing loads of stuff. Or doing stuff. Ben Yedder got a 13-minute hat-trick. Raheem Sterling got a 13-minute hat-trick. Ribéry got, what was it, a 9-minute assist hat-trick? So everyone was in a rush this weekend. But Bayern are now top of the Bundesliga on goal difference, which is like...
Thanks to the hat-trick.
Well, thanks to just hammering everyone. Lewandowski's top scorer. Yeah. He's the top-scoring foreign player in Bundesliga history now. Yeah. Thiago Alcantara has come back and looked just like the supreme midfielder that he is.
That's the big change this season. But Bayern is not only is Thiago fit and back, but they've got Javi Martinez playing regularly at the base midfield behind. I think having those two together in midfield is just a game changer, because Thiago is everyone knows this, is excellent player, magnificent technique, but he's injury prone. He's injured all the time, and if he's not fully fit, he can be a bit of a sideshow. You know, he just sort of drifts through games. He's been fit. He's been really good. And Javi Martinez is just a rock next to him. Just really, really solid defensive fielder. Also, at the back, you have to say Neuer is finding something like Neuer form again after that his injury nightmare. Boateng and Hummels, who were disastrous in the summer, have warmed up. I mean, it sounds crazy because it's March, but they've finally warmed up to the season. They're starting to play reasonably well. You know, it's Bayern, an old team. They're a very, very, very old team, and it's taken them till March, but they're finally starting to warm up and actually start playing like Bayern. I mean, it took them until February, let's be honest. They've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's Leon Goretzka's goal haul in January, I think, really firing.
Yeah, and then he can't now get back inside through injury. But Müller scored in their last two Bundesliga games, obviously missing. Joshua Kimmich, who we mentioned before as one of the assist leaders, is not there.
That's the huge
Mane
thing.
His battle with Mane in the first leg, there was those visible celebrations of tackles from Kimmich.
That was so inexplicable.
But Mane also did get past him a few times, and obviously I can't remember if it was him that drew the yellow card, but I imagine it was. But anyway, that Mane will now, again, in the form that he's in, Rafinha is Mr. I'll play everywhere, not spectacular in any of it. That could be Liverpool's avenue to reopen those wounds.
Alaba didn't play today. I think they rested him, knowing that Mohamed Salah was coming midweek. I would imagine it will be Rafinha. And Yeah, you have to look at Liverpool. Again, I still think they'll build up primarily through Salah and Firmino, but I think now you're thinking, Rafinha, can he defend Mane? Because Mane's movement is so smart, I don't know. But Bayern, look, they're really motoring into gear now. They're almost Real Madriding it, really. They were useless for the first half of the season, and now they've sort of found their form. And of course, because Dortmund have just absolutely spectacularly choked it, they actually might... You know, they probably are going to go on and win the Bundesliga again now. I mean, they shouldn't really. Dortmund should have held their nerve and at least picked up some points, but they've been throwing points away like for fun, like they're Spurs or something.
Well,
so,
they got the curse of G. Osberg, that old Man City, old Sunderland striker that scored against Man City, famous thing, scored 2-1. But so Bayern predicting them to win the Bundesliga, but what about this tie in the weekend? Have you got any feelings on it?
I think
the Thiago Martinez pivot is huge.
It is huge, but if you just look at how they sort of set up, I mean, how they set up in that first game, they didn't really give much away in terms of like how they intend to approach this Champions League tie. Because, by the fact that they're playing at home and they're in such good form, you would expect to see a complete reverse of how they sort of sat back a little bit in the first leg. But
all right, Maurizio Sarri. No interest in playing football.
Low intensity defending. Yeah. Yeah. So that what makes it a difficult proposition. The Kimmich being out is a bit tricky as well. I do think Liverpool have an advantage in the sense that they didn't concede in that first leg. So,
and they've also got the best left back in Europe, according to Phil Neville, on that side as well.
Who am I to argue with the sage that is Phil Neville? I just think maybe 1-1 and then Liverpool
away goal it.
Yeah.
I was thinking that, but then I remembered that James Rodriguez... I was also thinking 1-1, but then I remembered James Rodriguez is sort of semi-finding form again, and I just think he's...
Yeah, I think they've now suggested that they're actually willing to...
Turns out a good player is good at football.
I just think he'll be the difference. I don't know why I have this feeling that he's going to pull something out of the bag, because everyone seems to have forgotten that he's absolutely brilliant. Mm. And I think it's just like He's right. I mean, Thiago will play well, and whatever. But I just think James is sort of ripe for a big. Oh, hey, remember me? I'm back.
An absolute banger in pop form. Potentially.
Yeah, I just think James will be.
He serves up like what he served up at the 2014 World Cup, in for a treat.
Yeah, so I'm saying. So I'm going to say 2-1 to Bayern. I think James Rodriguez is gonna take this opportunity to really shine his light on the Champions League.
Especially as
Real Madrid got dumped out.
The one thing I can't really see is Liverpool winning, just because of that away record recently. And in the Champions League in general this season, they've really not travelled very well.
I think it might be even 0-0. Like, it might go to extra time.
So
I think it might 0-0. I think it might 0-0, and then it will be. And then I think Bayern might take it, but that's only because I've fallen in. Thiago's one of those players that I don't watch for a while, and watch him again, fall completely and utterly in love with him again. And then any response that I make after that period where I've just watched him is an emotional response to watching him play. So I'm saying Bayern will win purely because of the fact that I've watched too many Thiago clips.
He's very seductive with his foot. He's a phenomenal footballer.
So seductive Thiago. Here's a segue. Someone that wasn't seductive enough was the second top scorers in the Championship, West Brom. Apparently, that's not good enough anymore. And Darren Moore has been sacked.
I was really hoping that wasn't a segue to the Jack Grealish incident.
No. Well, no, he was seductive in his own performance, because it's enough to draw a fan to try and punch him in the face. But we'll get on to Jack Grealish and fans on pitches in general just after this. But the Darren Moore thing was, and we were speaking just before the podcast about how it's so bizarre that you almost don't want to cast a too extreme judgment on it. But in fourth place... as I just mentioned, the second most goals in the Championship this season. He was obviously brilliant with them at the end of the Premier League season in terms of making them so difficult to beat and nearly getting a Premier League survival. Winning manager of the month in April last year and gone by March 2019.
He went toe-to-toe with some very highly rated managers that season. I think in Jose Mourinho, Pochettino and even Rafa Benitez potentially, and took points from those games.
He mugged Mourinho right off at Old Trafford. Yeah. I think this is very harsh. He wasn't Johan Cruyff or anything, but he was a very good manager. He organised them very well. They got they lost their best player, Harvey Barnes, in January, and to sack him. I mean, look, Troy Townsend, who works with Kick It Out, he pointed out that, you know, this is why we don't. He said, literally, and I quote, "Here's the reason we don't have more black managers right here." Quote tweet in their statement that sacked him. I mean, you can't. Yeah, a little bit of failure, a little bit of struggle, and they sacked him. The first sign, really, of struggle. I mean, I know they got relegated, but they were going to get relegated anyway. The fact that he even made it a close call was amazing last season. You can't see them sacking a white manager this quickly, this readily. Like, he wasn't necessarily doing anything wrong. Like you said, second top scorers in the championship.
Their recent form had drawn cause for concern. If you look at what the fans have said, and I think you mentioned that, Will.
So it was obviously widely condemned by sort of mainstream media. And then you've got the perspective from West Brom fans, many of whom said they were sad but not shocked. They've had issues with where he was playing Dwight Gayle out wide a little bit, the defence on Harvey Barnes, as Mo's alluded to, and their desperation to earn promotion straight away, which they sort of outlined in their statement on the sacking. But when you look at the fact they allowed Alan Pardew to go on like a 9-game losing streak last season before they finally pulled the trigger on that one, it does seem very unfair.
Seems very unfair. And I think the Harvey Barnes thing is huge, because West Brom have had a nice round number, 500 shots. Harvey Barnes hasn't played for the club since the 1st of January. He still had the most shots in the team, which again isn't necessarily bad because he was taking some very speculative efforts. But he's also created the second most chances for the team. He's completed the most take-ons still in the team, provided the second most assists in the team.
Yeah.
When you lose someone like that and you can't do much about it, and as I said, he hasn't played since the 1st of January, West Brom had potential opportunities to try and cover that. Obviously, the partnership of Rodriguez and Gayle up front scoring loads of goals, but it feels very harsh on a manager when one of your main assets and seemingly who they're... to funnel that much output through one player, you can't deny that they were obviously building around or at least including Harvey Barnes as the main role in the team. To lose that and then the only money they've spent this season was on a goalkeeper and a defender, I think for all of this to fall on a manager especially makes it even more ridiculous, regardless of their position in the league, their recent form. I feel like the lack of responsibility taken for, like, we're not going to give you this, but then if you don't do well with that...
Yeah, so they would say, I'm sure, that by retaining some of their best players and batting away all offers, they were sort of giving him a chance. And it's often said that West Brom have the best squad in that division.
Yeah.
Whether that's totally the case, I can't speak to that too much. But
yeah. Well, they sold Ben Foster, Nasir Chadli and James McLean.
I think it's ultimately what you can objectively say about this is that it is a cynical decision in that they're clearly preying on a new manager bounce coming in.
Djukanovic, I sort of mentioned this morning.
Djukanovic has been touted. Yeah,
yeah, to me,
Wagner as well as another one.
To me, it's just it's not fair. It's harsh. It's I know that, you know, it's not that that Darren Moore was you know, again, he wasn't the greatest manager in the world, but the fact that he actually, you know, what he did last season, the way he almost kept them up, which is absurd, because if you looked at how bad they were when he took over, there was no way they were staying up. The fact that he even made it a conversation, a possibility, he took it to as late as he did, that was incredible. What he did to top managers last season in the Premier League, that was incredible. We lost a whole bunch of players, lost Rondon, lost Ben Foster, lost Johnny Evans as well, you know, in the summer. You know, these are big, experienced players. Yeah, still have a good squad. Okay, fine. But, you know, to not allow him any sort of bumps at all and to just sack him straight away, you're fighting for your Premier League. Like, if they were fighting for their Premier League survival, this sort of ruthlessness almost, you could sort of say, okay, fine, I think that you don't want to go down. Or if they were fighting for their championship survival, like, okay, you definitely don't want to avoid double relegation. Okay, fine, you got to sack him. But...
If they were in the relegation zone, he would have been sacked a long time.
Yeah, but my point is they're doing all right.
But financially, it's kind of the same. Fighting for Premier League survival and fighting for Championship promotion is kind of the same incentive. Yeah. It's the big money in the Premier League.
It lacks long-term vision, which is sort of, again, a product of the Premier League, the commercialised world of football.
It's the case. It's like if you own a football club in the Championship, the owner can't really expect to turn much of a profit on their club. If you're in the Premier League, there's potential.
So all in all, it was it's shocking. There's some arguments you can make. for and against. It's all a bit bizarre. Overall, I think we all agree that it's probably
it's a hard decision, and frankly, it looks, whether or not it is or not, it looks quite discriminatory, to be perfectly honest. Whether or not it is or not, but I can't, they wouldn't have done this to Adam Pardew, for instance. Like, you know, and they didn't. They gave him, what, nine game, like you said. So the whole thing stinks, to be honest, whether or not it's made with all the best intentions or not, which it doesn't look like it is to me, to be honest.
So if this is a harsh punishment for Darren Moore's dip in form, another incident in West Midlands, Birmingham area, was obviously a fan coming on the pitch and swinging at Jack Grealish, who then went on to score the winner in the second City derby, which
that,
is pretty
as you tell the kids, is the best way to get revenge.
I saw a tweet saying, like, oh, imagine being the copper that walks past his cell and says, Grealish just scored the winner, mate. It makes it no worth it. But just quickly on that, and obviously we had the instance in Scottish football at the moment,
James Tavernier,
and there was the steward who tried to keep kneeling
the steward in it, and then also at Arsenal as well, the fan running on the pitch brushing past Smalling. Ashley Young saying, what if one day someone's carrying something and the players aren't being protected?
So three incidents on one weekend, that applies an enormous amount of pressure on the EFL or FA to come down quite hard on Birmingham. Obviously many will have seen the Gary Neville tweet suggesting a points deduction behind closed doors.
Alan Shearer said that as well.
Alan Shearer as well. I think everyone's calling for quite a severe punishment here. So Birmingham should probably be quite worried.
Yeah, I just think you need to punish the club just to prevent anything like this from happening. It needs to be very harsh. I don't think people would, like, if you lose points for it, if you cost your team points for it, like, then you're not going to do that, because that's ultimately,
I think, mechanically what that punishment then does is that it creates an environment in which fans will police each other's actions.
And also, like, the clubs will take a lot more seriously as well. They'll take stewarding a lot more seriously. Like, you know, it's not the stewards themselves, but
they need more of them. You need response to that. And I think,
you've got a stand full of like 20,000 people. You've got, like, what, 15 stewards? That's not enough. You know, that's what I'm talking about. It's not necessarily the stewards themselves' fault. They're just the guys trying to do their job. Clubs will take stewarding more seriously if there's a risk of points deduction if people come onto the pitch.
And as well, in a really cynical way, Birmingham, I'm just looking at the Championship table now, Birmingham are 11th, 50 points, 17 off relegation. It's a chance to, like, I can imagine making decisions like this is, people find it really difficult when it's having an impact, but it's not going to affect Birmingham's season, so you might as well just... There's no excuse not to come. There's going to be no serious ramifications for them this season, apart from the fact that you show that if you do this again and you're fighting for a league title or you're on the verge of relegation, then it's going to cost your team that season. So I think we all agree that one, absolutely moronic behaviour anyway. And there needs to be, so glad to see West Birmingham immediately say he's banned for life, but I think we agree there needs to be more. But coming up after a little break is a lighter discussion, and it will be our second Squawker Six, and it's going to be a set piece special. As on last week's episode, the final part of today's podcast will be a Squawker Six, in which I ask the guests and myself to pick a player for each of six categories. And this week is a set piece special, considering we saw quite a few tasty examples of it at the weekend. I'll be asking each guest to pick a throw-in taker, a corner taker, a direct free kick taker, an indirect free kick taker, a penalty taker, and also, to avoid anything a bit odd in terms of size of corners, I'm also going to ask a goalie that you'd put in goal to save a penalty. This week, I'm going to start with Mo on this one, as Will got the honours last time out. Over to you. Take us through your Squawker Six set-piece special.
All right, well, I'm going to start with the penalty saver, the goalkeeper. I'm going to go with, of course, the big man, Samir Handanovic, Inter Milan captain, who has 38 career penalty saves, including two this season, one against everyone's favourite, Nico Barea. Yeah, he's just a great penalty saver. He's big, he dives very well. He always, you know, guesses the right way. I would have guessed, if this was 2 years ago, I would have said Diego Alves, but it's not, so I'm just going with Handanovic.
I had Diego Alves on my shortlist.
Yeah, I mean, he was legendary back in the day. Penalties, I'm going to shock a lot of people, but I'm going to go with Eden Hazard, who I'm often very critical of, but who has to be the most nails penalty taker I think I've seen, maybe ever. You know, just doesn't seem to, I don't think he's, has he missed? It doesn't seem to miss.
He should have checked that before he chose him.
He's got 6 of 6 in the Premier League since the start of last season, so he hasn't missed that regard. I'm trying to think back into the mist of time. Has he missed before? I can't remember him missing. He's so good. He does this thing where he can guess or he can shoot. Just shoot anyway. He's phenomenal. He's a brilliant penalty taker. I was going to go with Milivojevic, but I thought, nah, you know what? Eden Hazard plus the Panenka in an elimination penalty in a cup final to pull off a Panenka is just so
pretty
good. It's
pretty impressive stuff.
And then free kick indirect. There's a lot of options here. A lot of players you could have gone for. I've gone for Ryan Fraser. Because I like him.
That must be the most rogue. I was not expecting that.
I like being a bit rogue.
He was a name I stumbled across when I was looking.
He used to play for Aberdeen. I went to university in Aberdeen, so I'm just a bit of loyalty there. No, he's created 13 chances from set pieces this season, 3 assists. So he's a good player. He's a good winger, good for a free kick taker. Obviously, I could have gone with a whole number of players like Koke or whatever, but I thought, nah. Direct free kick taker, the one and only Lionel Messi. 8 free kicks scored in 2018. You know, I mean, he's the big man. Has he scored one in 2019?
My analysis of this section will blow you out of the water.
I can imagine it will. I'm really just waiting for you to bring the numbers down. Like a sledgehammer onto a bus tire. Corner taker, again, there's so many different options. I'm going to go with Koke from Atletico Madrid. Because, you know, it's Koke. Yeah. Who doesn't love Koke? And then
the Champions League prediction wizard.
Something about
Spanish number sixes.
I mean,
Xavi absolutely smashing the Asian Cup one. And now Koke is... Who actually predicted that Man City would go out to Schalke? So if he was on the Squawker Talker podcast...
Let's go.
He would have said Schalke.
Let's go ask Nacho and see what's coming up next, man. Let's get the sixes opinion. And the throw-ins... Well, there's only one person here, isn't there? It's Milad Mohammadi. He of the somersault throw-in.
Yeah, he was on my shortlist.
The only one. I don't care. You can come at me with assists.
I was so hoping that someone was going to pick him.
But there's only one man I want taking my throw-ins, and it's him. I don't care about numbers here, efficiency, anything like that. I don't care. Yeah. He can hit the first man every time. I don't care.
Well, when you've got such good other set-piece takers in your team, then your throw-ins can just be for the fans.
Hell yeah.
You just want to do a bit of fun. So just run through your list.
So penalty saver is Handanovic. Penalty is Eden Hazard. Freaky kick director is Ryan Fraser, rogue shout. Free kick director is Lionel Messi. Corner taker is Koke. And throw-in taker is Milad Mohammadi.
That is a nice list. Most Squawker 6 of set-piece takers there. And with that, we move on to you, Will. Do you have an equally as surprising and interesting list of players?
Yeah, I've gone above and beyond that might annoy you. And I've done one current and one historic. Oh, I'm going to rattle through them, though, don't worry.
Yeah.
Number one for throw-in. Lubo Baronin, a Serbian player who can essentially throw the ball from the halfway line into the box. Words can't do it justice, so YouTube search his name.
Is this your current or historic?
He's current. He's still active. Historic, Rory Delap, no explanation needed. Yeah. Corner, Jao Moutinho. I think he's got like 5 assists or something from a corner in like over the winter in the Premier League alone.
Getting your Kevin De Bruyne shout in.
Historic. Charlie Tully, a Northern Irishman who played for Celtic in the late 40s and 50s.
Oh, all right, Mr.
And is said to have scored 11 goals from corners in total, according to a Guardian article I read that was dated back to 2007. He managed the trick on one particular occasion in 1953 during a cup match against Falkirk. But because the referee assumed the ball must have been placed outside the corner arc, it was ordered to be retaken. Tully did so and scored again.
Oh my God. So he's just Charlie Mulgrew is him. Charlie Mulgrew scored 3 this season.
Moving swiftly on, direct free kick, I've gone for Lionel Messi.
Yeah.
And David Beckham, historic, because icon.
Yeah.
Indirect free kick, James Ward-Prowse.
Indirect.
Yes, I'm on board with Guardiola's shout. And then historic, Andrea Pirlo. Penalty,
Yeah.
Sergio Ramos, king of La Liga's Penenka. Historic, Zinedine Zidane. Because if anyone has the cojones to perform a Penenka in the World Cup final, then they're down on my list.
You got it wrong.
And being sick beforehand. I love it how historic. You literally both named a penalty taker that the penalty was named after and picked someone that did a rendition of it, which is always just, I find funny. I think people forget Penenka is a man.
Yes, Penenka is a man who did it. It did it in a final as well.
And penalty save, for current, I went for the same as Mo Samir Handanovic, who's, as you said, saved 38 out of 103. And that is, well, that's according to Transfer Market, which is 37% of the penalties faced, which is outrageous. And for historic, Mikel Landreau, who was nicknamed Monsieur Penalty and spooked Ronaldinho in a game between Nantes and PSG in France's in a League Cup game in 2002 by standing like 2 meters away from one post,
the classic,
and then sort of like
that's what I do on FIFA,
and and then sort of coming back towards the center and then diving backwards when Ronaldinho put it that side of the goal. Also check that out on YouTube.
Just done some he's done some serious research there. So we've got a current and historic. As Mo said, I think that is probably the most fun you've had on Wikipedia in quite a while.
Yeah,
looking for those.
Yeah.
And now the one that you've all been waiting for.
Here we go. Bring out the numbers.
No, some of them are numbers-based because I did a bit of it. Some of them are just sort of theory crafting. I'll start with throwing. And although he hasn't been seen to do it in a while, you just think with Liverpool's throwing coach having this much free time with Joe Gomez, who had a quite good long throw in itself.
That's true.
I've picked Joe Gomez because he's been trained. I can imagine a sort of Karate Kid-esque film.
You're the
best. Like wax on, wax off with throwing.
That montage would be lovely to see.
So the ability to maybe get some actual like spin on it and stuff. I've gone with Joe Gomez because he's being coached and obviously his current player. Corner taker. So this is where James Ward-Prowse first comes into mention because Pep Guardiola called him the best corner taker in the Premier League. However, I wanted to save him. And I've gone for a corner at Santi Cazorla. Because what more do you want than someone that can just take a corner from either side with either foot? And also was pretty good at them for Arsenal. But it's the both-footedness there.
That is sound logic.
Creating multiple angles.
And also,
he's no Charlie Tully, but logic is sound.
Well, it's funny that you placed emphasis on scoring directly from the corner as a corner taker when there wasn't. It's not like it's going to be. It's not like there's not going to be any other players in the box.
Yeah.
You just went, I need him to score directly from it, and that's it. Because as I mentioned, Charlie Mulgrew famously has scored quite a few this season already. So direct free kick, my shortlist involves Lionel Messi, obviously, because of the records, Paulo Dybala, Miralem Pjanic, Antoine Griezmann. Historic would have been Juninho Pernambucano for me.
Big man.
Simone Verdi, who is another two-footed player, and that has all those players that I mentioned after Lionel Messi have a higher success rate in at least the last few three or four seasons, based on an article that we did fairly recently. However, the one player that had the best is a young Macedonian international called Enis Bardi that plays for Levante. And watch him take free kicks because they are special.
Bardi is
my direct free kick taker. Not on this Lionel Messi business.
Bardi's an artist.
And obviously, James Ward-Prowse again came into my mention.
I just wanted to put him down as like at least three of these.
Yeah, so this is what I'm saying. So because you didn't want to pick, I didn't want to just come up with my throw-in taker, James Ward-Prowse. Again, direct free kick. He scored two in a week against Man United and Spurs. Obviously,
two quite good goalkeepers as well.
Exactly, and sort of he might be free kicking his way into the England squad based on his recent form. But I also picked him, and it's funny that we've come for the same one for this. He's my indirect free kick taker purely because you can't have a set piece scorker six without James Ward-Prowse in it. But
you can, mate.
Based on my Cazorla logic for the two-footedness and the direct free kick based on pure sort of efficiency, despite small sample size. James Ward-Prowse comes in as my indirect free kick taker. Penalty takers. I have not Paul Pogba, because it was a chance to get a good stat in. If he misses another penalty in the Premier League, first player to miss four in a single season. So definitely not Paul Pogba. And then other players that came into my mentions were Balotelli, Mark Noble, Luka Milivojevic also. But I think the one penalty to take at the moment that just stuns me every time he takes one is Harry Kane. Because
Yaya Toure also. Yaya Toure, still active.
Yeah, that was another one I was flirting with, because obviously famously never missed in the Premier League. But Harry Kane, I just think the fact that he absolutely thunderbolts it into any corner of the net with pretty much no sweat.
Yeah, he's really good at sort of disguising what side he's going for as well, I find.
But funnily enough, Loris Karius can say that he saved a Harry Kane penalty.
Wow.
But Loris Karius is actually quite good at saving penalties, but not good enough.
Simon Mignolet was as well.
Yeah, not good enough to be my penalty saver in my final selection. Again, Diego Alves came up, Aurelio Gomez came up, who might not still be active. Can't remember if he's just on the bench. Someone that I thought about that I thought Mo was going to choose was Jasper Cillessen, purely because of Barcelona and also the fact that he was literally brought on in a World Cup for a penalty shootout.
Tim Krul.
Oh, it was the opposite way around.
Tim Krul.
My knowledge. So there you go. My penalty saver is Tim Krul. I thought that was so odd. I should have researched that, because then I realised that his penalty saving stuff wasn't actually that good. So I'm lucky I didn't pick him.
Yes.
I thought that was your choice.
No. So it's not my choice.
Absolutely screwed.
I was trying to be really clever and say that I've thought loads of possibilities.
Because we would have had to accept your first answer.
Yeah, you would have had to accept, and I would have looked stupid. But it's another itch that I've chosen, but it's Daniel Subasic, who may not have as many total saves as Handanovic yet, but obviously at the World Cup became the first goalkeeper since Ricardo to save three in a shootout, and also has a quite simply phenomenal record.
I forgot how good the goalkeepers were at the World Cup.
I know. So another one that you could mention in here is Pickford, but I noticed a trend with him is that if you go down the middle, Pickford will save it because he extends his feet, but where people take the mick out of him for his small arms, you surely should just go for the corners. And then Donnarumma was
a risky strategy, Jordan.
Donnarumma was another one that I had because he's massive, and Jan Oblak just for being a goalie. But Subasic is what I went for because of his World Cup heroics. So overall, my score 6. Throw in Joe Gomez, corner Santi Cazorla, direct free kick Enes Bardi, indirect free kick James Ward-Prowse, penalties Harry Kane, and penalty saver Daniel Subasic. So what we want you to do is just get involved with your own Squawker Sixes by replying to the tweet that you'll see about the Squawker Talker. You also need to rate and subscribe to the Squawker Talker and let us know if you've got any ideas for Squawker Sixes in the future. But that is all we have time for this week. So one final thank you to my guest, Mo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for being awesome.
And thank you, Will, for being awesome.
It was my pleasure to be awesome.
A nice triangle of praise there. And we'll see you next week.